The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Another beautiful morning in our beautiful city. I wonder if you ever feel unsafe in our city. Ever feel like you're personally in danger? Maybe it's out late at night, some dark place or something, and you feel uneasy, or it's walking across that dark bridge at night. Well, let me tell you, statistically, the most dangerous thing you can do, or perhaps the most dangerous place that you can be, is at home with your domestic partner, cooking with a carving knife or something. That is statistically the most dangerous thing that you can do. So today we're talking about homicide or murder. Well, here's some stats. The National Homicide Monitoring Program through the Australian Institute of Criminology says this, that of homicide victims, those who have been murdered, 87% of victims knew their killer. 41% of them were in a domestic relationship and most commonly in an intimate relationship. 27% were acquaintances, and only 13% of people who are murdered by a stranger. In terms of murder weapons, 38% stab wounds, a knife, etc., 25% beatings, and 14% firearms. So it's actually safer to cook with a handgun than a carving knife, but, the statistics don't lie, that's right. In terms of homicide rates per 100,000 people per annum, lest I give you the wrong view of Australia, we are a very safe country. At the moment, we're actually about, with the decimal point, etc., about one person per 100,000 per annum. The United States, as you might expect, is a little higher at 4.7 persons. The United Nations estimates 6.2 persons, like as a global average, 6.2 persons per 100,000. And there are some countries that are outliers. So, for example, Colombia, 30 times Australia's murder rate at 30 per 100, and South Africa 31 times, 31 persons per 100,000. So we come today to the topic of murder and the Sixth Commandment, and you'll be pleased to know we're against it. Given two things, firstly that everyone's against murder, of course, and also no one ever does it, and none of us would ever be tempted, it'll be a very easy talk to give and to listen to. And don't you believe it? Because as usual, when you look at the teachings of Jesus, Jesus gets right through and puts his finger on the heart of the matter, and we all have something to listen to. So we're working our way through parts of the Ten Commandments. The first three of the Ten Commandments are about how to respond, or they're given to ancient Israel, not to make them God's people, but once they are God's people, how it's a summary of how then they should live. The first three commandments are about how to respond to God personally in terms of worship and loyalty. The next seven, 4 through to 10, are essentially about the relationships that will make society healthy. And what I find interesting is God doesn't give them a bill of rights. God gives them a list of obligations to other people. And this is how you are to live in terms of healthy relationships within society. So today, the sixth commandment, do not murder. And we'll take you through quickly in your outline. You'll see these headings and some parts of the Bible. The commandment in ancient Israel, the commandment taken for granted, the commandment in our world, and then the commandment in our lives. So, the commandment in ancient Israel. Quite simple, really. Exodus 20, verse 13, you shall not murder. Now, sometimes people will say, will want to paraphrase this or translate it, say, oh, you shall not kill. But that's not what it says. The Hebrew word rashak, forgive the pronunciation, rashak. The root of the word is the idea of dashing to pieces. And when you look up what the scholars tell us, it's used of killing an enemy in a violent and premeditated way. So murder, our English word murder, is a good translation. It doesn't work to just say you shall not kill. In the Old Testament, there are instructions, for example, there were crimes that carried capital punishment. There are instructions for going to war, and inevitably people are killed in war, etc. The Sixth Commandment is about personal violence, one person taking the life of another. What I find interesting, and I realise I'm talking to a room full of lawyers, The Old Testament took intention into account. In other words, did you intend, was it deliberate that you killed someone? Exodus, part of the Old Testament law, Exodus 21:12, anyone who strikes a person with a fatal blow is to be put to death. So murder carried the death penalty. However, if it is not done intentionally, but God lets it happen, in other words, if it's an accident, right, or not intended, God lets it happen, they are to flee to a place I will designate. And in the ancient law, what they did was, in Israel, God set up three, as it was called, cities of refuge. So if you killed someone accidentally, you could run there and take safety while the authorities sorted it out, and you were safe from family vengeance, etc. The avenger of blood, as it's called. So you could run there, and then due process would hopefully save you. Now, it's worth asking the question, though, why this commandment? Why is there a commandment saying you cannot, murder is wrong, you cannot take human life, whereas in the Bible's point of view, it's okay to kill sheep or cattle or chickens or whatever it is to eat them? Now, I know we may not all agree with that. Some of us will say you shouldn't eat meat, but in the Bible's point of view, you can't kill people. Cows, chickens, etc. is fine. Well, it's all about a big theme in the Bible. The way the Bible understands humanity is that we are created in the image of God. And that's found as early as the book of Genesis, in the beautiful poetic explanation of creation. Day six, as God creates the world and his creatures, we're told this about the creation of humanity. Genesis 1, verse 26. Then God said, "Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky and over the livestock and all the wild animals and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female. He created them. Now, there's different theories about what the image of God means exactly. There's nowhere that the Bible gives you three bullet points about what the image of God means exactly. Some people have said, well, it's the fact that we are relational, we're capable of relationship, we have language, we can express thoughts, we're rational. Others have said, well, now notice the idea of image is, built into that is the idea of ruling over creation. Not exploiting it, not raping creation, but the idea of caring for it, developing it, etc. God put Adam and Eve to be gardeners in the Garden of Eden, and so it's been God's representative to rule the world. I suspect it's all of those things. You put all of those things together, you get this picture that we are different to the animal kingdom. In Genesis, it's only humanity that have, quote, the breath of God breathed into us, and we become a living being. Now, that carries implications for how we're to treat our fellow human beings. God says he will hold humans accountable for how we treat other human beings. So Genesis chapter 9, verse 6, whoever sheds human blood, by humans shall their blood be shed. For, why? In the image of God, he has made mankind. It is very important how you treat other creatures in the image of God. All human life is special. All human life has particular value, regardless of how much power they carry, regardless of what they're able to contribute to society. Now, you might say, well, of course all human life is valuable. Thank you, Captain Obvious. Everyone knows that. Not true. Many, many... In fact, our culture is unusual in holding that view, or that used to hold that view, should I say, perhaps. In the ancient world, for example, in the Greco-Roman world, human life was valued very differently. And I don't just mean the gladiators murdering each other in the arena for the joy of the crowds. The way that, for example, babies, etc., were viewed. Rodney Stark's book, The Commandment We Take for Granted, Rodney Stark's book, The Rise of Christianity. Now, I know I quote Rodney Stark all the time. I haven't quoted Rodney for at least a week. All right, so here we go. Rodney, so The Rise of Christianity is a brilliant book, particularly the second half of it. How did the Christians go from just a few thousand in the middle of the first century to having enough of a movement that eventually they Christianized the Roman Empire? Well, one of the key factors was the way that they regarded women, or should I say, female babies. Listen to what he says. Men greatly outnumbered women in the Greco-Roman world. Dio Cassius, writing about 200 BC, attributed the declining population of the empire to the extreme shortage of females. Russell, in 1958, estimated that there were 131 males for every 100 females in the city of Rome, and 140 males per 100 females in Italy, Asia Minor, and North Africa. Russell noticed in passing that sex ratios this extreme can only occur when there has been, quote, some tampering with human life. And tampering there was. Exposure of unwanted female infants and deformed male infants was legal, morally accepted, and widely practiced by all social classes in the Greco-Roman world. Lindsay reported that even in large families, more than one daughter was practically never reared. Both Plato and Aristotle recommended infanticide as legitimate state policy. The 12 Tables, the earliest Roman the earliest known Roman legal code, written about 450 BC, permitted a father to expose any female infant and any deformed or weak male infant. In fact, Stark goes on to say part of the reason that the Christian movement grew so quickly is that they didn't expose or murder their female babies. And so more and more they had equal numbers of men and women, and so were at a much higher birth rate. The value we put on human life at the beginning and the end in our society is largely a result of Christian influence. Now, does everyone share that today? Well, no, it doesn't. Let me show you in our world today. Here's a very interesting book. I think his first name is pronounced Yuval. Yuval Noah Harari is a lecturer in history at the University of Jerusalem. He's a brilliant writer. I'm enjoying reading this. I disagree with him on almost every page. He's a hardcore atheist, very clear in his ideas, etc. I've got to say, I disagree with almost everything he says, but it's a brilliant book. He talks that for him, there's no God or gods. We are simply a branch. We're hairless great apes who, some of us more than others, remember, hairless great apes who took a right turn from chimpanzees about 6 million years ago, and so here we are. He talks about the Ache Indians who were in the jungles of Paraguay until around the 1960s. Listen to what he says about the Ache Indians. The Ache people, or hunters and gatherers who lived in the jungles of Paraguay until the 1960s, they offer a glimpse into the darker side of being hunters and gatherers, or foragers. When a valued member of the tribe died, the Ache customarily killed a little girl and buried the two of them together. When an old Ache woman became a burden to the rest of the band, one of the younger men would sneak behind her and kill her with an axe blow to the head. An Ache man told inquisitive anthropologists stories of, quote, his prime years in the jungle. He said, quote, "I customarily killed old women. I used to kill my aunts. The women were afraid of me. Now here with the whites, I have become weak. Also, babies born without hair were considered underdeveloped and were killed immediately." Now, Professor Harari says, "We should be careful, though, not to judge the Ache too quickly. They were extremely generous with their possessions. They were not obsessed with success or wealth. The things they valued most in life were good social interactions and high-quality friendships. They viewed the killing of children, sick people, and the elderly as many people today would view abortion and euthanasia." And that's exactly right. They viewed it the way people today would view abortion and euthanasia. Now, those two topics are highly emotional and very difficult. Let me say just a couple of things. It's very hard to go past this without saying something. It's hard to know how many abortions happen in Australia year by year. Only the South Australian government publishes figures. The other are published under multiple medical procedures that hide the numbers. The best estimate is 80 to 90,000 abortions in Australia. That means approximately one abortion for every 2.8 live births. Nobody says that that's a good thing. In terms of euthanasia, the push for euthanasia continues. I think there's been close to 30 times around Australia that that bill has been brought up and defeated each time, except last year, I think it was, in Victoria. The Victorian government has now legalised some forms of euthanasia. On your program, I've put a talk, or the URL for a talk, and a recording, and also the transcript of a talk given by Dr. Megan Best. Dr. Best's a palliative care specialist, and she has a PhD in bioethics. If anybody knows this field, she does. Regardless of what you think about euthanasia, I'd encourage you to listen to someone who's an expert in the field and has been involved in this for so long, and to hear what she says. I think it's interesting, she says, we're told in different surveys that 85% of Australians are in favour of euthanasia, and yet the medical profession generally is not. And she also says the closer that a doctor works to the field of people actually dying, the smaller the percentage of them are actually in favour of euthanasia. And so I invite you to listen to what she says. The reason this is such a difficult topic, these two are such difficult topics, it's very hard to actually talk people. What people tend to do is demonise the other side. But it's not, this is not an arm wrestle between people who have compassion and people who don't, or people who have morals and people who don't. This is a matter of different worldviews. And if you have a different worldview about humanity and who we are, you'll come out with different priorities in that. So it's bringing a totally different worldview about who humanity is, what we're worth and what gives us worth and how we came to be. And that works itself out in very different ways. Let me give you an example. Yuval Noah Harari is a compassionate man. As I read the book, he spoke about the Aceh Indians, etc. And then a few pages later, he has several pages on how cruel humanity have been in the domestication of animals and some examples of extreme cruelty. And he's right, we've been cruel, and he's a very compassionate man about that. But let me show you how his worldview works out. He says this: egg-laying hens, dairy cows and draft animals are sometimes allowed to live for many years, but the price is subjugation to a way of life completely alien to their urges and desires. It's reasonable to assume, for example, that bulls prefer to spend their days wandering over open prairies in the company of other bulls and cows, rather than pulling carts and ploughs under the yoke of a whip-wielding ape. Now, you may not wield a whip, you may use a fountain pen or a keyboard, but that's his worldview. And you can see how that will work out very differently to someone who has the worldview of humanity created in the image of God. It's the hard question to work out is which one is true. Which one is true? Well, let me move on. The commandment in our lives. As usual, what Jesus teaches gets to the heart of the matter. The Ten Commandments are given at Mount Sinai about 1400 BC. Over the next 1400 years, for one reason or another, the religious leaders of the nation of Israel had turned the law of God into a shell. They kept the externals, but not the heart of the law, not what God had truly wanted or wanted from the heart of those who know him. And Jesus reaches out and shows what the heart of the law aimed at. And so as Jesus speaks in the Sermon on the Mount, and this is on the left-hand, the left-hand side of your program, Jesus says this as he discusses the difference between external law-keeping versus from the heart. He says, Matthew 5:21, you have heard that it was said to people long ago, you shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. So they're saying, well, look, as long as you haven't actually stabbed someone or strangled them, you haven't physically murdered them, then that's okay. In fact, I've had people say to me, well, I'm a good person, I've never murdered anyone. So if you apply that test, fine. But Jesus says, no. What's the heart of the matter? The heart of the matter has to do with anger. And he goes on to say in verse 22, he says, but I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, raka, is answerable to the court. And anyone who says, you fool, be in danger of the fire of hell. What's he saying? God will judge us for our heart attitude to others. Now, just to kind of pull that apart, see, the idea of racha was a kind of an insult. How was it? Bonehead, buffhead, you idiot, that kind of thing. Okay. He's saying, sure, if you insulted someone in society, they could take you to the court of the Sanhedrin. But Jesus says, no, if you call someone fool, which was a term of contempt, really, more honest, you can work out where the English words come from, a term of contempt, saying your contempt for others is actually poison. It can take you on the road to hell. Don't cherish or nurse anger or contempt for other people. Because I think anger leads in only one direction. Anger leads in only one direction. I think it's okay for me to say this. I have three daughters, so I'm not saying which one it was. But one of my lovely girls, at about the age of 15, got a job at Kmart. And she would work on the checkout at Kmart. And what would happen is they'd have a sale, and people would come and buy a whole lot of stuff. And then the next week, they'd bring it back. And they'd have lost price tags, or they'd have pulled labels off, and she'd be trying to get price checks, and it'd take forever, and the people would be rude and impatient. And after a couple of weeks, she came home and she said to me, Dad, I hate the customers. I hate the customers at Kmart. And I said, yes, honey, I understand. She said, no, Dad, you don't understand. I want to hurt them. And here's my sweet little girl has looked inside and seen this dark thing in her heart that she wants to... Well, the story has a happy ending. She resigned after a couple of weeks and no one got hurt, fortunately. But I think she'd seen something. Now, John Calvin, who's a very famous Bible teacher, theologian from about the 16th century, said this, see whether you can be angry against your brother or sister. See whether you can be angry against your brother without burning with a desire to hurt him. And it is, isn't it? It's anger that leads us to hurt others, whether that be verbally or in some other action or physically. There's a reason that 87% of people who are murdered by someone who knows them. And you're most likely to be murdered by your closest relationships. Why? Because anger builds up over time, and then the explosion and bang, it happens. So what does Jesus say? Deal with it. Deal with anger quickly. So I won't go through, I'm running out of time. See, verses 23, 24, if you're a Christian believer, if you're a follower of Jesus, deal with it quickly. Go and ask forgiveness and be reconciled with your fellow believers. Or if you have an adversary, in verses 25, 26, go and sort that out with them quickly before you appear before the judge. And I'm sure that he's referring to actually before you appear before God. Because what does he say? What does the rest of the New Testament say? It says this. Don't brood on anger. Now, I know the old saying, you know, revenge is a dish best eaten cold. And I you can see the point, can't you? Revenge is a dish best eaten cold. But don't brood over anger. Because if we do, anger will actually take over our whole life. Haven't you met people you want to say, man, you are one angry man. Huh? All the time. Where does road rage come from? I'll tell you where it comes from. When the anger bucket is full, you've just got to bump it and it spills. That's, you know. Or social media. So much self-righteous anger about, mostly from people who have too much time on their hands, I think. What does the Apostle Paul say when he writes to the Christians in Ephesus, which would be in modern-day Turkey? He says this, in your anger, do not sin. And notice, you can be angry and not sin. If your anger is about something that's right and true, or particularly about how someone else has been treated, or the poor, or the vulnerable, Jesus gets angry in Mark chapter 3, but about how someone else was treated badly. It said, for me, mostly, my anger is just selfishness. I didn't get what I wanted. Or it's that kind of middle-aged male background grumpiness. I know I'd be the only one in the room that ever suffered from that, but okay, confessions. In your anger, do not sin. See what he says? Do not let the sun go down while you're still angry, and do not give the devil a foothold. Deal with it quickly. Drag it out in the sunshine while the sun's still shining, and see that mostly it's just selfishness. The idea of don't give the devil a foothold, I think that the evil one uses anger as a great kind of hook. Anger that's gone cold turns into bitterness, or malice, and it's poison. And you've just got to read the story of Cain and Abel, that very succinct, beautiful little story, well, terrible story, really, in Genesis 4, about what bitterness and malice ultimately become. And so, if we struggle with that, we should be asking God for forgiveness, and he's more than ready to forgive, and then also fixing things up with other people. What Jesus does as he comes to the New Testament is to take the negative of do not murder and turn it into something, or emphasize it as something positive. I'll show you. In Romans chapter 13, so the Apostle Paul writing to the Christians in Rome, he says this: let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. For whoever loves others has fulfilled the law. Now, the Ten Commandments give us a summary of the law. Whoever loves others has fulfilled the law. He goes on, the commandments: you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and whatever other command there may be, are summed up in this one command: love your neighbour as yourself. It's a quote from the book of Leviticus, but Jesus quoted that as well as the great commandment about how to relate to people. Love your neighbour as yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbour, therefore love is the fulfilment of the law. And so as you listen to Jesus and trust him, do not murder becomes love your neighbour as yourself. Okay, some interesting questions. Any thoughts on the role of the devil as a murderer from the beginning? John chapter 8. Yes, in John chapter 8, Jesus links the devil or the evil one being a liar and a murderer from the beginning. And what he's referring back to is the deception or the lie that the evil one brings to the man and the woman, Adam and Eve, to represent humanity, that God is not ultimately good and God is not ultimately wise and so doesn't want or know what's best for them. And if they ignore God and do their own thing, they'll be like him. And of course, the great lie is, well, it's half true. They can ignore God, make their own, but ultimately it means that they die. The lie of the evil one actually takes life rather than gives it, which is why I think Jesus talks about him being a murderer, the one who destroys life or takes it. Why do we love murder stories? Why the fascination? I'm not sure. My wife loves reading stories about serial killers. So I lie in bed beside this woman in her Kindle reading about serial... Anyway, I'm not sure. Perhaps it's because it's almost, as we feel, the ultimate taboo. And so once someone's crossed that line and killed someone, it's that fascination of what could push someone to do that. And then how would you live with that? I suspect that could be it, but I no real... I just like Westerns myself, but she likes they serial killers. What was that, sir?
They do shoot
each other, yes. But at least we know it's not real. That's the... Okay. What motivated the religious leaders to distort God's law? Was it that they saw themselves being above God? No. Now, I have read in different places, but I'm not 100% sure that this is true, but that the Pharisees were the nationalistic Jewish group. They were laymen. They weren't ordained priests, and they had a conservative view of Scripture. The Sadducees, who you hear, were actually Hellenized or greatly influenced by Greek culture. They were the aristocrats. They didn't actually believe in life after death. And so they had control of the priesthood. They were the upper classes. The Pharisees were the Jewish nationalist lay people. I've read that they believed that if for one day all of Israel kept the law of God perfectly, then the Messiah would return. And that was part of their agenda. I think that's right, but I haven't been able to anchor that enough to be completely sure. What they had done is look to keep the law of God, but really look for the minimum requirement. And what they would do is to say, well, we're going to keep the law of God, but let's put a fence around the law and by making more and more and more rules. And so the Sabbath, you weren't supposed to work on the Sabbath. Well, that would include how do we stop anyone working on the Sabbath? Okay, well, a woman wasn't supposed to look in a mirror because if she saw a grey hair, she might be tempted to pull it out. You weren't supposed to spit on the ground because if you spat, your spit would hit, roll, and it would be like farming. So they ended up with more and more and more and more rules. But in the end, their heart wasn't in it, in serving God. And that's where Jesus' great conflict with the religious leaders had come from. You can actually set out to obey the rules, but not actually have your heart in what it's all about. So I used to live in Newtown in a narrow little street, and the speed limit was 50 k's or whatever it was, and there was one woman that lived near us, and she used to drive at 50 k's down the street. Now, that was incredibly dangerous with little kids everywhere, but she was actually keeping the law. If her heart had been in it, she would have just chugged down the street slowly. So you can keep the rules and not keep the heart of what it is. Where does suicide fit in to this? Yes, good question. Some people have taught that if you commit suicide, it's a mortal sin and you will automatically go to hell. I don't think the Bible says that. What the Bible does say is that because we're created in the image of God, because we have value, God is the one who should decide the beginning and the end of life, and so you shouldn't take your own life. Where this has come from, partly the Roman Catholic Church, I think, with respect, I think the Roman Catholic Church has taught this, and some other Protestant churches, and even the church that I was taken to as a kid. It comes from a misunderstanding, a part of an older translation that said, if anyone takes their life, they'll lose it. And if the idea of take your life becomes, you say, oh, well, that's suicide. No. What Jesus means is, if you take hold of your own life and keep it for yourself, ultimately you'll lose it. The alternative is to give him your life and you'll find it. So it's that misunderstanding. Now, suicide's a terrible thing, and you'd never encourage anyone to do it, so you'd never say that anyone should do it. But sometimes as a result of mental illness, that can happen. And I would say, tentatively, carefully, people who are severely depressed and not functioning well mentally may actually take their own life. It may happen that way. I cannot see how that is totally different to some other kind of disease that takes someone's life. So I definitely don't think that idea of if someone's taken their own life, they're automatically going to go to hell. I think that is not what the Bible says. Having gone through the long experience of my parents' decline and then passing, both of them had were only strengthened by faith, and my opposition. Both of them has only strengthened my faith and my opposition to euthanasia. Either Christians oppose the culture of death, or this new paganism will consume our society. Yes. What I was trying to say is the difference is not compassion or not compassion. So, for example, Andrew Denton had become an advocate for euthanasia, but that's because he saw his dad die very painfully and slowly. Now, it's compassion that drives him. Dr. Best is against it, and it's compassion that drives her. There's very much a difference about the world view. The difficulty is trying to make decisions regarding individuals when governments need to make decisions about society as a whole. And that's why I encourage you to go and listen to that talk from Dr. Best. She'll say things like this. Most decisions where people want euthanasia are actually made in anticipation of pain rather than in the middle of the pain itself. When people get to the end of life, they want more time, not less time. And she also talks about the bracket creep that has happened in the Netherlands, for example, in the last 20 years, when now you start with euthanasia of those who are mentally competent and facing terminal illness, etc. Now you've got to the point in the Netherlands where people are being euthanized even when they haven't asked for it, or people who are feeling depressed, or teenagers, etc., who want it. So it's not just end of life. It's now anyone who really doesn't want to live or doesn't feel like it. Listen to her talk about it. That's she's a very wise lady. Is the decreasing ability of Christians to be effective in the public sphere a result of them not being angry enough? It's right to be angry about injustice, But anger doesn't motivate other people. Action motivates other people. Action and argument. And I think it's not wrong for people, for Christians to be involved in the public square or the political process. We just need to be wise in the way that we do it. But anger itself doesn't motivate other people. What we need is clear thinking, like freedom for faith, in terms of how to be involved in the public square as Christians. Peter? Yes, sir.
Can I get a clarification?
Yes.
You've said twice that the difference in attitude comes from the difference in worldview. I'll put words in your mouth and you can disavow them. Are you saying that Andrew Denton, on the one hand, is coming from the side of compassion, but he doesn't regard the preservation of life as being an ultimate, whereas the woman who presumably is a Christian and is a palliative nurse specialist,
yes,
does? Because if you don't mean that, I'm not quite sure what you're saying, because on the one hand, both are, one person is compassionate, saying, I don't want my parent to die in pain. The other person is saying, I'm assuming, someone doesn't have to die in pain if they get proper palliative care, and the two are not inconsistent, so I'm a bit confused.
Yes. Different worldviews will bring different priorities.
So, different views,
Well, let me give you an example. This man says it's wrong to be cruel to domestic animals because really we're just a whip-wielding ape. When you actually put that into practice, you're going to have a very different value of human beings, say, at the beginning and end of life. That's why he can hear about the Aceh Indians and kind of shrug his shoulders, right? He's saying the value of human life at the very beginning or the very end, he doesn't believe in the image of God. Andrew Denton, yes, motivated by compassion. Megan Best, motivated by compassion. The question really is, is what Jesus says about us as the image of God, is that correct? And I prefer to take it back to his authority, is he truly the Son of God, etc. What Megan will say in that talk about euthanasia is, there's a huge amount of misunderstanding about end-of-life issues. And she's saying, isn't it strange that now this has become an issue, now that there's been huge advances in medicine, that palliative care is much more advanced, that we're able to reduce the level of people's pain at the end of life, etc. So there's different... My point was just to say, you need to be careful not to demonise the other side, because both sides tend to say, you don't care, you're not compassionate, we are the ones who care, when I think both sides are motivated by compassion. The difference is, what do you understand about humanity? Maybe I've not been clear.
Push back. I don't follow the point, sir.
Okay. Do you want to push back a little bit again?
Yeah. I can understand the proposition that one person is coming from a view, a person is made in the image of God, their life is sacred, you don't take it.
Yes.
I can also understand the proposition, a human life is just a version of an ape. It is not sacred, it is not unique. You euthanise it like you do a sick dog.
Yep.
If that's the point you're making, I understand.
That's the point I'm making. Right, okay. Yeah, sorry, that's probably a better way than I put it, but that's exactly right. That's what I'm trying to say. Then it gets complicated about the actual technical medical side of things, and that's what Dr. Best talks about a fair bit. Yeah, thank you. Sorry if I wasn't clear.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.